And our political commentators are with us now this week. It's Stephen Mills and Bridget Morton. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, Stephen is the Executive Director of UMR Research, a former political advisor to two Labor governments. UMR does polling work for the Labor Party. Bridget Morton is a senior consultant with public and commercial law firm Franks and Ogilvy, a former senior ministerial advisor for the previous National-led government. Right, it's COVID this week as things stand. And I think we were beginning to discuss this last week, actually. There's a sense of a pivotal moment in mood shift with this latest lockdown now lifted, and the reflections are, could it have been avoided if officials had all the information they needed before announcing it last Saturday night? And is part of the reason they didn't have all the information to do with issues with their messaging? Who wants to lead off? Stephen, do you want to go first?
Hey, look, I'd start just by questioning, at least to some degree, until we have evidence, whether there has been a mass change in mood. I think there's always been people unhappy about lockdowns, some for ideological reasons, some because they see things sort of totally through the prism of their own lives and convenience, some downplay the seriousness of COVID. And I think as time's got on, probably there's more of those, and people in other categories have probably got a bit more frayed. But I think the vast majority is still kind of aware of how high the stakes are in this. And if we'd gone down the road of other countries like United States or Sweden, which many hard right instant public health experts were advising last year, you know, there would have been thousands of deaths, equivalent of about 8,000 plus if we went down the USA road, and about 6,500 for Sweden. And I think people are also very aware of the dangers of the new variants. So, you know, while I think there is grumpiness, I don't think there's been this kind of complete flip in mood, which the media seems to have concluded.
I wouldn't presume that's what's being asserted either. It is frustration, it is fatigue, it is fraying of the edges, it is questioning over whether the precision in the government's actions is where it should be after a year. And some of that mood change is evident even in the Prime Minister's, direct calling out of people who've actually been able to push back and say some of what happened wasn't our fault.
You know, I think there's certainly issues in compliance, and we discussed those, but I'd just like to make the point that as of now, there is no empirical evidence of a big change in mood. Ashley Bloomfield pointed out that the traffic volumes at the same level for level three in August 2020 in Auckland, and there was a big response in tests. And our polling, which covered the three-day lockdown, our most recent poll for corporate clients, and the beginnings of the seven-day lockdown, showed no change in the vote, no change in the Prime Minister's ratings, and if anything, a bit of a lift in the approval of the government's handling of COVID issues. So I think we should wait until we see, you know, evidence other than kind of anecdotal. I know I'm not in any way conceding, arguing that there's not greater grumpiness, but I think people are still basically behind what has to be done. And, you know, and to some extent anyway, with vaccination working overseas, the finish line, long way off, but still coming into view.
Yeah, that vaccination rollout will be another test, as and when it happens. And
the timetable, I think, will be really important, won't it? Because I think that gives people some certainty to kind of plan around, and also some kind of hope as well.
And again, last week, and we had it with a GP, rather, who's on the government's own immunisation advisory board, saying now is the time for more detail. And yes, we have to accept that things will change. They will change possibly for Australia as well. But in Australia, you can go onto an app and work out by demographic when you will expect to get what order you can expect to be vaccinated in, Bridget. So what do you take? I mean, I take Stephen's point. It's not like there's been some massive revolution here, but you definitely sense the patience is stretched, as one might expect, and the question is also how that is being handled. But what do you take of some of the conversations that have been had the last week and some of the messaging that's come out of the Beehive itself?
Yeah, I agree that we're not, you know, had a complete flip of mood here, but I think you've got to be really careful and really open to seeing that there is that frustration and that patience building, because we rely completely and utterly on that social peer pressure, essentially, to keep us, you know, our COVID levels low and keep us compliant with the measures in place. So I think the government does need to be really aware and cognizant of that sort of side of things. And I think some of the things that have been called over the last week, you know, I've seen calls for possibly a return of the epidemic response committee, select committee that was up and running during our first lockdown this time last year. The Nats have obviously called for an inquiry. I think that kind of stuff is actually really important. We can't, and the government can't assume that just having, you know, sort of 1 p.m. press conferences where they give lots of information is going to sustain it. People are becoming more frustrating, wanting more information, wanting to know that roadmap. And I think they need to be more aware of giving that accountability and that transparency.
The community itself in South Auckland is calling for that. And Councillor Collins is one of them who has been particularly, again, not negative, but just saying the right things with respect to how the community feels like there are better communications channels than you are going to get out of government agencies. And again, our GP was saying the same thing. You know, have they got to think more widely about how you reach into every pocket necessary when we see that just one little series of mistakes or mixed messages can have such an effect, Bridget?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really cumulative as well. Like, it builds really quickly on that one sort of message and that growing discontent. And I think that's particularly important as we go into this next phase, which is around the vaccines. I saw some polling the other week that about a quarter of people were, you know, wary of getting the vaccine. I mean, that's a really high number when we think that the vaccine's going to sort of solve all our problems here in New Zealand and that we're going to be able to, you know, move into this sort of post-COVID phase. So if we want that compliance, we want people, you know, getting the vaccine, I think we really need to solve the communication problems now.
What's your take on that poll, Stephen? It's an Horizon poll, and they use slightly different methodology from memory from other polls, but what did you make of that poll out, I think, over the weekend, indicating a significant level of vaccine hesitancy?
Yeah, with 69% will accept what they, the question wording said was well-tested and well-approved vaccine, so that was quite a strong, strong wording. 24% say they're unlikely to, and 11% that they definitely wouldn't, which added up a little high, but never mind. And that translated into those kind of pretty horrific headlines that 500,000 New Zealanders were unlikely to, and 391,000 of those definitely wouldn't take a vaccine. We've been tracking that, and we've got kind of similar numbers. We just have one single question in each month asking whether people would take a vaccine if it was available now free, and roughly three quarters each time have said they would, and a quarter of said they wouldn't. But when you go into more depth on those who wouldn't, including in qualitative research, it is kind of like there is a surprisingly high, I'd say, wait-and-see mood about it. They're concerned that it's been a bit quick. They're concerned about side effects and so on. And some say they don't want to be guinea pigs. That's a common phrase right throughout Australasia in discussing this issue. And some would delay until they kind of need a vaccine, like they want to travel, in which case their doubts would disappear and they'd take the vaccine. And we've got a sort of underneath sort of more 3-5% who are hardcore anti-vaxxers. And I mean, that's an issue, but the key communications challenge, I think, will be reaching those wait and see people. And I don't think that'll be too difficult. And as the evidence mounts overseas of the vaccinations being successful in bringing down the number of cases and bringing down the number of deaths, I think that will be manageable. Not to say it's not going to take a huge communications effort. And as you say, that's got to reach into every nook and cranny. I mean, I asked about this because that was one of the issues that was criticised about the communications for this Valentine's Day outbreak. There are 25 languages being used now. Maybe it needs to be more, I don't know. But, you know, an effort is being made. And government agencies are well versed in kind of reaching multi, different language audiences. So,
see, I question that, Stephen. I'm interested in your take on that, Bridget, because yes, they have their way of reaching people with different languages, but it's not just a language issue. It's about where do you get your information from, and crucially, I think it was Professor Collins who pointed this out. Who do you trust? Like, who are you going to respond and take the information from, Bridget? And I'm just not convinced about that. When you talk about, oh, we've consulted ethnic affairs, well, bless, but it's another bureaucracy, you know? And I do wonder, particularly getting into the vaccination stage, again, can we learn more about what their plan is? We also learnt from last week, and Claire Trevett on the Herald wrote an excellent summary of this, that some of what was said about information provided to the likes of the KFC worker, who particularly strongly pushed back, actually wasn't what was on the website. And we heard about 15 texts and letters and this, but some of that information did not marry up and changed. And again, it sounds like nitpicking, except that these are the sorts of things that plunge us back into a lockdown.
Yeah, and I think the language is so important. And when you translate that and how you communicate that, it can change quite considerably. You know, we've had a lot of discussions and there's a lot of confusion about what contact plus close contact plus, like, those words are even confusing.
Just
in
lose
the original
it. Just
way
say
written,
you're in a category where you stay home, or you're in a category where you don't have to stay home.
It's super confusing. And as soon as that gets, as you say, translated, that can lose its meaning really quickly, depending on, who you trust, who you're getting information from. You know, the other week when we had Facebook, you know, pulled all the news from sites in Australia, and there's that sort of horror realisation that a huge portion of the population gets their news from social media. And that's the same thing here. Like, you can't assume that just because you see the 1 p.m. press conference, you listen to Morning Report, you watch the 6 o'clock news, that that's what everyone else is watching and listening as well. You've got to take the information to the people where they are.
And it may be that you need intermediaries who are more effective than getting their cooperation than you are. And this is particularly important when it comes to vaccination and all the BS that will be flying around out there. Stephen, to your point, we're getting real-time clinical studies coming in from other countries. One of the benefits of having to wait for the vaccine is that a lot of those things you raised are going to be hard data to show what adverse events are and efficacy is. But who's going to communicate that to every single last New Zealander, particularly the reluctant? And where are they at in understanding how they are going to best communicate and by whom?
Well, they do need to look at review what happened this time and to what extent they can improve their communications. I think it will be a kind of major and very high cost effort to get through to as many as possible on vaccination. But I mean, nobody's not saying there's lessons that had to be learned out of this. And, Claire Trevett's article was really interesting. I started to kind of get my head around this at the beginning of the weekend, and her article saved me a huge amount of work. I was developing a terrible headache with LMNs and O's.
Thanks, Claire.
thank you. And Audrey Young's article was very good as well. I think between them, they kind of nailed it. It was, really good journalism. And Claire did make it clear there's, lack of clarity around the rules for testing at levels 1 and 2, which applied with that gym case. But then, common sense is if you've got symptoms, you get tested and you go home and wait to find out what the result is rather than to go to the gym and around town and not to record your contacts as well. But, I think the context here has been missed to some extent. 2 weeks ago, I expressed my very lay, uninformed surprise that we'd come out of the 3-day lockdown without a run of community transmission zeros. And they are handling these differently now to avoid lockdowns and reduce them. In 2020, it was simple. It was, those 14-day cycles. And now this one was only 7 days, even though at the time the decision was made, they did not know the source of the infection for one of the cases. And they seem to be, both widening the net to the, close and casual contacts and tightening the net as well. And, and I think you could say that there was a really positive result that, last year in the Auckland lockdown, that began on 12th of August at level 3, and Auckland didn't get to level 1 till 7th of October. And, hopefully there won't be any kind of ramifications from that latest case. It'll be a lot quicker this time. And there have been kind of lessons learned on that. And, Chris Simpkins made that point this morning, that maybe with, close and close plus and casual plus, the communications challenges had got too tough, and that does need to be simplified.
It's about looking forward too, though, and it's interesting, the business leaders, five, six businesses, I think, came forward last week as well and saying, let us in on the path and on the plan out of here. And look, I know, Stephen, to your point, everyone's an expert and everyone's got their opinion, but actually these people are experts on some things. And I do wonder if, understandably, the fatigue is not just the populace, but those who are working in the front lines of managing this response, and whether you can end up almost tunnel visioned, this is working for us, just keep the course. Whereas actually we're getting to a point where we need to look beyond, we need to look through and how the vaccination is going to happen. Businesses need some information on what the rules are going to be as we go through this next process. And Bridget, do we sense there's an open-mindedness to broaden the tent, which happened for a time right at the beginning?
Yeah, I don't think there is that open mind right now. I do remember back, yeah, this time last year where we actually had business leaders doing things that the government wasn't able to do, you know, relying on their international contacts to get PPE into the country and that sort of thing. So I think it would be good if the government was more open-minded to that. But there does seem to be the sense of any suggestion that is put up by anyone that is not that sort of key leadership group out of government just gets slapped away really quickly. There doesn't seem to be that discussion. And I sort of therefore go back to my sort of, you know, point at the beginning that I do follow those calls for an inquiry or an epidemic response committee to be stood up again, because I do think we need some other vehicle for people to be able to put these ideas in, to push back, to have that sort of accountability coming through.
All right. What did you make of the government hiking isolation fees? Stephen?
Could I just say I don't think there's, you know, any evidence that the government isn't open to other suggestions. And Chris Hipton has made that very point in response to the Rob Campbell interview on Q&A, that they did have experts in logistics and so on involved from the private sector already. I mean, I didn't quite know what that call was by Rob Campbell, that it seemed to be to have a voice in making the decisions. But whenever Jack Tame challenged him on that, he said, no, everybody should make the decisions, which, you know, means no decisions will be made. And I don't think the government, you know, I don't think Bridget would be aware of exactly what approaches have been made to the government and rebuffed. But, you know, I'm certainly not aware of any. I think they are open to any private sector help.
They want to plan. And look, again, we are working in this extraordinary time, and there needs to be a maturity everywhere that your plan is not locked in stone. But it's the same with the vaccinations. And people point overseas to Australia, and 1A, 1B, 1C, 1D, all these details, no dates attached. They've got the same issues we have on waiting for vaccines to arrive. But there is a clear and public plan that people can mentally rehearse. And as I said, there's an app where you can go and see where you sit in the queue. And there's just this sense that everyone is having to sit and wait until when, actually, you know? And I think that is what's coming from business as well. Where is that least the sort of broad brief of where we head from here?
Well, I think the vaccination timetable should be out soon. There seems to be building towards that, so it won't be too far behind Australia. Australia has got the capacity to produce vaccine, which enables them to give at least a greater certainty, I would have thought. And I mean, like, people always ask for certainty. I've heard this, you know, my whole time in politics. And, you know, even in normal times, certainty is very hard to provide. I mean, it's almost as if the, people who criticise yo-yoing in and out of lockdowns, that they think there's a capricious government sitting down and thinking, oh, business has had it easy for the last 3 weeks, let's hit them with a lockdown. Now, everybody's at the mercy, you know, whether the virus gets into the country or not. And, you know, you cannot provide certainty in those circumstances. But, I fully agree that I think getting that vaccine timetable out is kind of a matter of urgency. And I think it will provide, I mean, it can never provide certainty, because who knows what could happen with another variant. And, you know, the vaccines may be held up, as has been the case in Australia, where their kind of orders have been kind of frozen in Europe. You know, that sort of thing, you know, means there's, you know, every possibility of further uncertainty, but at least people have got targets they can aim for.
As we said, it's not certainty, it's the sense of a plan. And again, you know, just listening to senior South Auckland GPs last week, Bridget, they're at a point where they're ready. The community is ready. They've been through this lockdown again. They've had these conversations with the people they trust in their communities, and they're ready. And that is an argument for South Auckland being reasonably high in the priority list, along with all the others. But again, we don't even know what the starting point for the priority list is yet, other than in the vaguest terms. Is it being unfair to ask for at least more of a broad-based plan, be it economic or be it vaccination, to begin to emerge now?
No, I think it's absolutely fair. And I do completely understand Stephen's point that providing certainty in times like this is incredibly hard to do.
There isn't.
But you should be able to provide certainty over the things you can control. And what the government can control is who's going to get the vaccine first, in what order, and how that's going to be prioritised. Give some people some comfort that there is a plan, that there is somebody looking at this big picture. Because there is no doubt that this work is being done. But it's not being seen by the public. And until the public can see it, they don't have that same sense of comfort that they need.
There is absolutely no doubt this work is being done. And it is, of course, a range of scenarios, depending on what happens, what you do if there's an outbreak at the time, changes to whether there's no outbreak. But trust us with some more trust us with some more. Now, to the sense of, to the move of hiking isolation fees, Stephen, I came to you first. Is this really about reflecting the real costs of MIQ when we're spending somewhere in the region of $50 billion on COVID, or is it about something else?
Well, they've made it clear it's not covering all the costs. What do you think the something else is?
Rationing. Rationing at a time where they've had advice from epidemiologists to do so. But at the same time, when we discuss this, people say you can't. New Zealanders have a right to return, and there's a human rights consideration over rationing the numbers. This is a way of doing it, potentially, is it not?
Yeah, well, obviously there's more demand for places than can be coped with. It was quite interesting that, I think it was Q&A, hopefully I got that right, did a run round of expatriate New Zealanders, and basically all of them were saying they'd like to come home, but no, there's no chance. They seem to have accepted that. Yeah, it is a way of doing that, I suppose. There are waivers for undue financial hardship and other special circumstances, so hopefully those will be used in cases where there is, you know, humanitarian need. I mean, I have a bit of discomfort over it. It's quite high levels now, you know, for a family.
Heck yeah.
So it's rationing to the wealthy rather than to the needy, unless those waivers are in place. And, you know, the people who are asked to do that, you know, it is for our own good. I know there's a segment out there who kind of really bitch and moan about people getting, you know, four-star hotel treatment at cut rates. They still probably do, even though the rates are now, you know, it's like it's 5,000, 5,500 for one person, 2,000, almost 3,000 for an additional adult, and 1,600 for each child. So that's, you know, a substantial amount for a family in isolation. But people probably still see that as, you know, as being kind of, you know, cosseted. But, you know, the issue there is that they are doing it for the public good, and I think that should be kept in mind.
Your take, Bridget, is this about recovering real costs, or do you think there's something else at play?
I do think there's probably a rationing element to it. What I found really interesting was when I was looking into this, you know, ahead of today's sort of discussion, there wasn't a lot of outrage actually about these the hike in fees. There was, you know, some stories about particularly migrants coming in, visas, who'd been, you know, separated families, but there wasn't actually a lot of discussion. And having discussions with people not involved in politics and news, a lot of people didn't even know this had really occurred. Which is quite different to, you know, even 6 months ago when you had, I think, a lot more people still trying to get back from overseas. Now you've kind of got people more and making the decision, you know, the more the long-term decision to come back rather than that sort of panic decision to come back. So on the ground here in New Zealand, you know, closeted away, you know, safely here, there doesn't actually seem to be a lot of domestic outrage. So for the government to put up these fees, it was kind of low-cost political for them to do.
Sure.
So it doesn't really push back on them at all.
Sure.
There's a segment of New Zealanders who think that people overseas have had more than enough time to come back already and should not be allowed to, and if they are allowed to, they should be made to pay full costs. So, you know, I don't think the politics of this really played any part in that. It's not a big issue. But, yeah, it's not, as Bridget says, there's little political cost in this for the government and some extra revenue.
Right, thanks both of you as always. Much appreciated. Bridget Morton and Stephen Mills.